Hey, I'm Steph.
I'm Alex.
And this is Not Today.
And we're live.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I am just as great and very excited for today's episode.
Good. Me too. I am so interested in this topic, and almost everyone in my life that I've told that I'm doing an episode on the plague, they're like just as hype as I am. I did not realize how widespread the interest on the plague was, but it truly is.
Almost as widespread as the plague.
Okay. You know?
Hey, is this your Roman Empire?
That's a good question.
Where you think about it on a weekly basis?
I would not say that I think about the plague on a weekly basis, but the past 3 weeks, it's my Roman Empire.
Yeah, fair enough. So, I don't know. I guess you kind of have a little book report.
Oh,
you know?
I for sure have a little book report. It's like I'm doing a project in social studies. But there was a TikTok that was made where someone actually, I believe, did this. Like, they wrote lyrics to a song. It was to the tune of Holla Back Girl, okay?
Oh, this and is great.
They rewrote the lyrics to be about the plague, which I did for my sister. This was not my project, but I did it about Pompeii to the tune of Love Shack. So this is a project that I've done before. But anyway, point being, she wrote one about the plague, and it's been stuck in my head since I heard it, and now that I'm actually researching the plague, all I can do is sing this song in my head. And I don't even remember all the words, but it's like, it'll make your tongue all black, girl. You'll be dead in no time, flat, girl. And then it says, fleas on rats, fleas on rats. It is too good. Whoever wrote that, shout out to you, because that's incredible.
It's so catchy. I mean, obviously, the original song is, but I mean, Fleas on Rats.
Fleas on Rats, to me, is better than Holla Back Girl, personally. So, yes, with all that said, we are talking about the plague today. And you might be thinking, hey, girl, isn't this a survival story podcast? Didn't millions of people die? Yes. But there were people who survived the plague, and there was a very specific place where a lot of people survived the plague, and it's very interesting. So we're going to talk about that in this episode. But first, I'm going to give you a whole rundown on the actual plague itself, and then we'll get into the interesting part. Well, it's all interesting, but you know what I mean. We'll get into the other side of the plague.
Okay, please tell me you've come with numbers.
I've come with some numbers. There's definitely a few numbers in this episode.
Hell yeah.
But it's, you know, also a lot of morbid facts and disgusting things, like symptoms.
As plagues go,
right,
that does tend to happen.
So why don't we get started? The bubonic plague is one of three types of plague caused by the bacterium Yersinia pestis, or Y. pestis. The bubonic plague is an infection of the lymphatic system, usually resulting from the bite of an infected flea. It may also result from exposure to the bodily fluids from a dead plague-infected animal or person. In the bubonic form of plague, the bacteria enters the skin through a flea bite and travels via the lymphatic vessels to a lymph node, causing it to swell. 1 to 7 days after exposure to the bacteria, flu-like symptoms develop. The best-known symptom of bubonic plague is one or more infected, enlarged, and painful lymph nodes known as buboes.
You're joking.
I am not joking. Buboes are bad. They're like massive bulges around your skin that are incredibly swollen, and like, I'm not talking about boobs. You're looking at me.
I know, but I'm just like, this is like a clown name. Like, oh, this is Bubos the clown. He's here for your kid's 5th birthday.
It does sound like a clown name. You're right.
But now we're talking about the plague. This is so silly.
That's true. No, buboes were actually a really bad symptom to have because they would like swell and burst, and it was incredibly painful. So they most commonly appear in the armpits, groin, or neck, and buboes are tender and painful. They vary in size from about less than 1/2 inch to about 4 inches.
No thanks.
Yeah. These buboes will grow and become more painful over time, often to the point of bursting, like I said. Symptoms include heavy breathing, continuous vomiting of blood, aching limbs, coughing, and extreme pain caused by the decay or decomposition of the skin while the person is still alive. Acral necrosis is also another symptom. It's the dark discoloration of skin. It basically makes your fingers and like extremities turn black. And it is why the Black Death was called the Black Death, because like parts of your body would actually physically turn black and then you would die.
How fun.
Yeah, bad. Additional symptoms include extreme fatigue, gastrointestinal problems, spleen inflammation, lenticulae, which I hope I'm saying right. They're black dots scattered throughout the body. Delirium, coma, organ failure, and death. Organ failure is a result of the bacteria infecting organs through the bloodstream. Other forms of the disease include septicemic plague and pneumonic plague, in which the bacterium reproduces in the person's blood and lungs, respectively. Septicemic plague occurs when plague bacteria multiply in the bloodstream, and during that plague, buboes may not be present, so it makes it kind of harder to know if it's the plague or not. And early symptoms include sudden high fever and chills, extreme weakness, stomach pain, diarrhea, and vomiting. And more serious symptoms may develop with the advanced disease and organ failure. These include bleeding from the mouth, nose, or rectum, or under the skin, signs of shock such as seizure, rash, and low blood pressure, blackening and death of tissue, like I mentioned, on the fingers, toes, ears, and nose. And that all sounds pretty freaking terrible, but pneumonic plague was the absolute worst, because that's when the plague hits the lungs and it can spread from person to person, like in the air.
Oh.
Yeah. And we'll talk more about pneumonic plague a little bit later, but that's 100% the worst one.
Wait, so are they all the same thing?
Yeah, they're
just
all
in different places?
Pretty much. Yeah. So septicemic is when it gets in the blood, pneumonic is when it's in the lungs. And the bubonic plague is when it's in like the lymph nodes.
But via the skin?
Yeah.
Okay.
So the first reported epidemic affected the Sasanian Empire and their arch rivals, the Byzantine Empire, and was named the Plague of Justinian after Emperor Justinian I, who was infected but survived through extensive treatment. I don't know what that means exactly, but apparently he survived the plague.
What year would that have been in?
549 AD.
Yeah, what, did they give him water and, like, lettuce?
Walk it off. The pandemic resulted in the deaths of an estimated 25 million to 50 million people after two centuries of reoccurrence. And I looked up how many people were alive at that time, like, in the world, and it was approximately 180 million.
Wow, so almost a third. Well, yeah. I guess over 200 years, but...
Right, but still, I mean, 50 million people out of 180, that's a lot.
It's a lot.
In the spring of 542, lol, the plague arrived in Constantinople, working its way from port city to port city and spreading around the Mediterranean Sea, later migrating inland eastward into Asia and west into Greece and Italy. The Plague of Justinian is said to have been completed, quote-unquote, in the middle of the 8th century. Because the infectious disease spread inland by the transferring of merchandise through Justinian's efforts in acquiring luxury goods of the time and exporting supplies, his capital became the leading exporter of the bubonic plague. So medieval society's increasing population was put to a screeching halt when, in the late Middle Ages, Europe experienced the deadliest disease outbreak in history. They called it the Great Dying or the Great Pestilence, which was later coined the Black Death. And that occurred from 1346 to 1352, at least the first time. The Black Death claimed one-third of the European human population, having a mortality rate as high as 70 to 80%.
Wow. Those are not good odds. So you're saying that it started in 500-something?
Yeah.
And then it took until 1350 to kill a third of the people?
I guess so, yeah. I mean, it's kind of popped up and, like, went away and then re-popped up, like, a lot of times throughout history. So it's not that crazy.
Okay, so this must have been, like, a specific mutation of it, I have to imagine, because I just don't feel like it would be around that long and not kill a third of people until, like, just one day for right. No reason.
Yeah, it's hard to say why it goes away and comes back, but that is, like, a reoccurring thing.
Okay.
But it did start in the Asia area first, and then it came over to Europe.
Okay.
So in the fall of 1347, 12 ships from the Black Sea entered the Sicilian port of Messina, carrying with them an extremely gruesome cargo. Most sailors aboard the ships were dead, and on the deck of the ship, and those who were still alive were gravely ill and covered in black boils that oozed blood and pus. And those dying of the plague definitely welcomed death at that point. So it was just a ship full of dead people and dying people who were, like, moaning and oozing terrible things. So seeing this, Sicilian authorities ordered the fleet of quote-unquote death ships straight out of the harbor, but unfortunately for them, it was already too late because mice on board the ship had already escaped to shore, and over the next 5 years, the Black Death would kill more than 20 million people in Europe, almost one-third of the continent's population. Even before the death ships pulled into port at Messina, many Europeans had heard rumors about the Great Pestilence that was carving a deadly path across the trade routes of the Near and Far East. So there had been talk that in the early 1340s, the disease had struck China, India, Persia, Syria, and Egypt, and now it was making its way to them. It was believed to have begun there, but recent research has indicated that the pathogen responsible for the Black Death may have existed in Europe as early as 3000 BC.
I just don't know what that means.
I mean, that's really long time ago, so...
Well, I know, but, like, how could it have existed that long ago? Again, like...
I am not a scientist.
And then only pop up literally 4,000 years later?
Yeah, it's a mystery to me. I am but a mere storyteller.
Okay.
So, listen to my tale.
I mean, I'm expecting you to be a virologist. What the fuck?
Okay, well, I'm not. So, let's keep going. Europeans were scarcely equipped for the horrible reality of the Black Death. Italian poet Giovanni Boccaccio wrote, quote, "In men and women alike, at the beginning of the malady, certain swellings, either on the groin or under the armpits, waxed to the bigness of a common apple, others to the size of an egg, some more and some less, and these the vulgar named plague boils. Blood and pus seeped out of these strange swellings, which were formed by a host of other unpleasant symptoms, fever, chills, vomiting, diarrhea, terrible aches and pains, and then, in short order, death. And soon, the signs and symptoms of the plague had erupted all over the city. If the infection reached the lungs, it became the pneumonic plague, which was even more deadly because it made the disease airborne. It would pass from person to person through their breath and coughing. Also, it was at that stage that death was inevitable. If you got the pneumonic plague, you were toast."
Oh, so it was 100%?
Yes, pneumonic plague is 100% deadly.
How did it not wipe out literally the entire face of the earth if it was airborne?
Well, I will tell you later. There is an answer to that question, but it's later on.
Okay.
Okay, great. And a person with pneumonic plague would die within 2 to 3 days. It was a very quick, painful death.
Well, at least it was quick.
I guess, but people were dropping like flies, and it was not like a painless death by any means.
Yeah.
It was a horrific way to die. Even today, the bacteria is still one of the most dangerous bacteriums we know of. It carries an extremely high mortality rate, like I just said. It's almost 100%. And actually, it has been used as, like, biological warfare.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
Isn't that crazy?
Once they figured out that it kills everyone, why wouldn't you just, like, send one guy into the village that you're trying to invade?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it's a terrible thing to do. That's, like... ethically wrong. Like,
well,
that's,
yeah, but
insane.
I mean, I feel like during a war in the 1300s,
well,
people weren't
was...
really concerned about ethics.
Well, no, but I'm not talking about biological warfare in the 1300s. I'm talking about, like, later on. Like, it's still around today, and it is still, like, heavily monitored today. And, like, I think for a time was used as biological warfare. Anyway, that's a side tangent, but isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
So the Black Death was terrifyingly, indiscriminately contagious. Boccaccio wrote, "The mere touching of the clothes appeared to itself communicate the malady to the toucher," meaning if you touch someone's clothes that had a flea on it, you're done. The disease was also terrifyingly efficient. People who were perfectly healthy when they went to bed at night could be dead by the morning.
That's so you could literally, anytime you went to sleep, could be your last.
Yeah. And actually, the children's nursery rhyme, Ring Around the Rosie, has been thought to be about the plague. Do you know it?
Oh, yeah.
Ring Around the Rosie, a pocket full of posies, ashes, ashes, they all fall down, is the rhyme for those who are not familiar. But the roses are a euphemism for the deadly rashes, like the bubos. And the posies are supposed to be a preventative measure because they're flowers. And people believed at some point that the plague was spread through the pungent smells of the death in the air. So they would buy flowers to protect themselves from the foul stench of disease. And also it kind of just covered up the stench of like dead bodies everywhere. But they truly thought that that's what was spreading the disease, was the smell of sickness. So they thought by smelling flowers, they were safe.
I don't know. Honestly, were they not kind of close?
No.
I mean, if it was airborne.
Yeah, but it wasn't like smelling a flower would keep you safe. It was.
I know, but I'm just saying, like, they kind of picked up, like, the air.
Yes, the airborne part, sure. But also, the rest of the rhyme, ashes, ashes, we all fall down, is, of course, alluding to burning bodies and dying.
And dying. And,
yeah.
You know.
So that's never been officially confirmed that it was about the plague, and there are alternate versions of the rhyme, but it does sound like it. If I had to put some money on it, it definitely lines up with the plague. The plague spread very quickly along the trade routes of Europe. Not long after it struck Messina, the Black Death spread to the port of Marseille in France and to the port of Tunis in North Africa. Then it reached Rome and Florence, two cities at the center of an elaborate web of trade routes, and by the middle of 1348, the Black Death had struck Paris, Bordeaux, Lyon, and London. So in a way, England got to watch as this horrible disease approached it, with nothing they could really do but wait for their turn. Because people were like writing letters about their travels and, you know, whatever, and England just had to like sit back and watch as it approached them. In September of 1348, the first deadly cargo of disease arrived in England. The ship docked in Southampton, quickly spreading the illness to London. The plague was so infectious and deadly that much of medieval England saw it as a punishment from God. It spread so quickly and killed so many people, there seemed to be no rational explanation for it, so they began blaming retribution for sins against God, such as greed, blasphemy, fornication, and worldliness. By this logic, the only way to overcome the plague was to win God's forgiveness. So some people believe that the way to do this was to purge their communities of the sinners and troublemakers. So society became more violent as the mass mortality rate cheapened life and also increased warfare, crime, and persecution because people believed that doing this in some way would put them in the good graces of God and they would be spared. So for no reason at all, many people pointed fingers at Jewish people for being patient zero, and many thousands of Jews were massacred in 1348 and 1349, and thousands more fled to the sparsely populated regions of Eastern Europe where they could be relatively safe from the rampaging mobs in the cities. Isn't that crazy? I had no idea that that was a part of it.
Yeah, me either.
Some people coped with the terror and uncertainty of the Black Death by lashing out at their neighbors, while others coped by turning inward and worrying about the condition of their own souls. So people were praying a lot, and priests were actually dying from the plague faster than anybody else, despite having a direct line to the big guy upstairs who should have been able to help them. And there were even some monasteries that lost every single monk to the plague. And that's where the flagellants came in.
Are you serious?
Not the farting. That's not what I'm talking about. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No. Is okay. It the death?
No. So flagellants are practitioners of a form of mortification of the flesh by whipping their skin with various instruments of penance. It's really violent and terrible, but it's basically these people who would whip themselves to, I guess, repent for their sins. So people were just like in the streets whipping themselves. It was like a group of people.
Dude, I can't imagine being alive during this time.
Yeah, there were plenty of people who, like, you know, writers, I don't know what they were, but they wrote that, like, this was the worst possible time to be alive, and they wished they were never born in this time period because it was just terrible.
Yeah, I mean, you have to think, you're like, of all times, you know, I just got the shittiest card.
Yeah.
Because it really just sounds like society really just went to shit.
It couldn't have gotten worse.
How long?
Yeah, I mean, years. Long time. So most of the like upper class and royalty fled London. Like they wanted to get as far away from there as possible because it was obviously spreading very quickly and they wanted to not die. But some upper class men joined processions of flagellants that traveled from town to town and engaged in public displays of penance and punishment. They would beat themselves and one another with heavy leather straps studded with sharp pieces of metal while the townspeople looked on. For 33 and a half days, the flagellants repeated this ritual 3 times a day. Then they would move on to the next town and begin the process over again.
It does sound like they're surviving a long time. You know what I mean?
They're not getting the plague.
33? Did any of them get the plague?
I'm sure they did, but who's to say? Although,
could you fucking imagine?
Some of them probably died. Some of them probably died from like whipping themselves and getting like,
oh yeah,
infected.
33 days, and then you just
3 times a day.
3 times a day.
Mm-hmm. And then they would just rinse and repeat. They would do it again in a new town. So these are the lengths.
What do they do for food?
I mean, who knows? They were eating like wherever they could. I guess they had to survive. But
I'm sure. But like, don't you guys have jobs?
No, this was their job. Like,
my job is to whip myself in the back.
Well, that was the thing, was that like merchants and like people with jobs, essentially, like they stopped working because businesses or whatever would like close their doors because everyone was dying, one, and two, they didn't know how it spread. So they didn't want to be with people.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, makes
sense. So the people who were whipping themselves, maybe they did have a job before, but now that it's the plague, I don't think they did. Boccaccio noted that many people became hedonists in the face of the plague. So on one side, you had the people who were like, repent, and if you are sinning, then you're going to get the plague. And then the other side of the people were like, actually, we're going to drink ourselves stupid, and we're going to enjoy life to the fullest and gratify all of one's cravings whenever the opportunity is offered. So it was people praying and sleeping together.
Just praying and fucking.
Correct. That's exactly what I meant.
I think I might have gone that way.
You know, yeah, maybe.
If like everyone's dying.
But the people who were...
I'm certainly not whipping myself.
Well, no. But the people who were getting together and drinking and, you know, sleeping with anyone they saw, like they probably got the plague faster because they were just going to be around a million people all the time.
True.
So it probably wasn't the best route. Anyway, there was a theory in Italy that the Black Death had been brought on by earthquakes, because before the plague hit Sicily, there had been a series of earthquakes. So some doctors claimed that these earthquakes had released pockets of corrupted air that caused the plague. And that smell should be taken with most caution, and it was known as miasma, a noxious form of bad air, which was why they were like buying flowers and smelling them to protect themselves from the bad air. There was also a theory that the plague was from the sky via a comet. The medical faculty at the University of Paris officially declared the celestial cause of the bubonic plague was from an astrological event. It was a triple conjunction of Saturn, Jupiter, and Mars in the 40th degree of Aquarius, occurring on March 20th, 1345, which created all the right elements together astrologically to start the deadly plague.
These are a lot of interesting theories. Did you say university?
Mm-hmm.
How long have they been around?
I think it was around the time of the plague. So it must have been like...
new? The university's new?
At the time, I don't know, but it was around then.
Interesting.
No one knew exactly how the Black Death was transmitted from one patient to another, and no one knew how to treat it. According to one doctor, for example, instantaneous death occurs when the aerial spirit escaping from the eyes of a sick man strikes the healthy person standing near and looking at the sick. So that was another theory. Physicians relied on crude and unsophisticated techniques such as bloodletting and boil lancing, which were dangerous and unsanitary in themselves, and superstitious practices such as burning aromatic herbs and bathing in rose water and vinegar. Like I mentioned earlier, they thought that flowers would prevent sickness, and to expand on that, plague doctors started wearing these insane face coverings and like full-on body costumes. So this costume consisted of a wide-brim leather hat, a mask with glass eyes and a beak, so like a bird face, a stick to remove clothes of a plague victim, gloves, waxed linen robe, and boots. So have you seen this image?
Oh, yeah. I feel like this is a mainstay of horror movies.
It is.
People will put that costume on because it just looks so incredibly creepy.
Yeah, the exact origin of the costume is unclear, but today it is a symbol of general horror and death. Often, plague doctors were the last thing a patient would see before death, and so they became the symbol of death. But yeah, it's basically like this black leather, like long curved beak with like big glass eyes. And they had straps that held the beak in front of the doctor's nose. And this mask had two small nose holes. And it was basically like a type of respirator which contained aromatic things in the beak. So they kept on this path of like flowers and other herbs. And so the beak could hold dried flowers. Commonly, they would use roses and carnations. They would use herbs like lavender and peppermint. They would use a vinegar sponge as well as juniper berry, cloves, myrrh, a bunch of other things. So it was just like, what can we shove in this bird nose that's going to make it good for me?
It is interesting to me how close they got. Like, this is kind of like a mask. I mean, it was intended to be like a mask.
Yeah.
Right?
So yeah.
I guess, you know, for the pneumonic plague, they got pretty close.
They did. And even though their theories about the plague and like the way it spread was incorrect, the costume actually did give the wearer some protection because the garments covered the body, shielding against blood spatter, lymph node and cough droplets. And the waxed robe prevented fleas from biting the doctor. And they weren't touching the bodies or clinging on to their like linen. So these plague doctor costumes actually served them really well. Like, it did prevent the plague in some regard.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So like, did fleas just not mess with linen?
No, they did, but they weren't wearing linen. They were wearing like...
Oh, the wax. Okay, so like the wax on the clothes stopped the fleas. They just don't do wax.
Yeah, I guess they couldn't like cling on to the fibers, and so it protected them.
That's so crazy. It seems so stupid, right?
Yeah.
But I guess it worked.
It really did. And doctors used wooden canes in order to point out areas that needed attention or to examine patients without touching them. So they were doing all the right things at this point. Other remedies included tying live chickens around your neck, since it was believed they could help with the bubos. And also, they used arsenic and mercury as treatments.
Wow.
Yeah.
How did that work out?
Bad. Obviously bad.
You were about to be like, well, mercury actually did function as a swelling reduction for the buboes.
Well, arsenic would kill you faster and probably less painfully. So,
that's true.
I don't know. No, those were all bad things. They tied chickens around their necks.
That is so crazy.
So it's pretty safe to say that this was a terrifying time because medicine in the Middle Ages and Renaissance was extremely basic. There really wasn't much as far as treating the illness went. There were more attempts at just not getting sick, which it seemed was their best course of action, because if you did get sick, more often than not, you were going to die. So in a panic, healthy people did all they could to avoid the sick. Doctors refused to see patients, priests refused to administer last rites, and shopkeepers closed their stores. Many people fled from the cities for the countryside, but even there, they could not escape the disease. And many people, desperate to save themselves, even abandoned their sick and dying loved ones. So the fear of the plague must have been all-consuming, because around 70% of the population died. So it's like people were literally dying by the thousands every single week.
I mean, that I can't even put that into context.
Yeah. They had to watch every day as carts full of dead bodies rolled past and just hope that they wouldn't catch it. It was pandemonium. Not only was the idea of catching the plague terrifying, but the streets were also alive with mourners and the stench of dead. At the height of the epidemic in England, they developed a strategy to attempt to limit the spread of the disease, which was quarantine. Sailors were held on their ships for 40 days, and while on land, if someone in a family got the plague, the whole family would be locked in a room for 40 days, and they would have padlocks on it, and they would have watchers to make sure nobody got out. So it didn't matter if only one person in that family had the plague, everyone was locked in the room. So if you needed it, nurses would be provided to you to like tend to you, which sounds nice, but these people were kept in terrible conditions. And if you were put into quarantine, it was basically a death sentence. After 40 days of exposure to the deadly disease, nobody was expected to come out alive. But it has been discovered that there were survivors. Plague historian Justin Champion found clues buried in the London archives that showed that. He compared the plague registers with the burial records to see just how many people had actually died from the plague in each household. Throughout London, he found pockets of resistance, and he found many, many more people contracted the disease than died. A very high proportion of them did die, but some people did survive the disease and the 40-day quarantine period, which was almost unheard of. So he wanted to know what made these people special and able to survive the world's most infectious and deadly disease. Scientist Dr. Stephen O'Brien had dedicated himself to answering that very question. He needed to find an area that had been struck with the plague with documented survivors of this quarantine. And eventually he found that in Eme, a village in Derbyshire, in like northern England.
I'm sorry. These are noises, not places. You said Eme?
It's Eme.
And then what else?
Derbyshire?
Derbyshire.
Yeah, correct.
Okay.
It looks like Derbyshire, but it's not. It's Derbyshire.
Sure. Okay.
Sure.
Sure.
So the town was the perfect place to research because it was a very isolated community in northern England. And they may have actually missed the plague altogether if it wasn't for a shipment of infected cloth. So that's how they got the plague. In September of 1665, when the plague had returned to London with a vengeance, a package arrived in Eme containing cloth from a London warehouse, and it was for the village tailor, George Vickers. Little did George Vickers know that when he hung this damp cloth to dry, fleas had jumped out of the cloth that carried the deadly plague bacterium. So the cloth was shaken out to prepare it to lay out, and after that day, Vickers had little red marks appear on his hands, which were flea bites. But he didn't realize what these marks were or that they were even there, so he had no idea that in a very short time, he would unfortunately be dead. It wasn't long before others in the town wound up dead from the plague, and the villagers realized their fate. The plague had finally hit them. The death toll in Eme began to skyrocket, as they did everywhere else. The village had no medical help, no apothecary, no nurses. It was a bad place to be sick. The only person the villagers could really call on for help was their rector.
What's a rector?
Like a priest.
Oh, okay.
The village rector was 28-year-old William Momsen, and upon discovering that the plague had hit Eme, he knew the village was doomed. But in order to try to stop the spread to other neighboring villages, he ordered an immediate quarantine of the entire village, which meant nobody was allowed in or out of Eme, and they put up signs everywhere, just warning people who were like coming by that they could not come into the village. And they also locked people into their homes. Like, they're like, we're not letting anyone out. And when the villagers first heard this, the shock must have been terrible because they realized if they didn't die of the plague, they would die of starvation because they didn't have an unlimited supply of food. They relied on getting things sent to them. And if they couldn't have that, they would very quickly starve to death. So that issue was solved by the Earl of Devonshire, who lived just a few miles away. And he agreed to supply as much food as he possibly could. So the food would be delivered to a desolate spot by a stone marker on the boundary of the village. And the villagers left whatever coins they had in return that were washed in vinegar. Because they had figured out that washing things in vinegar made it not contagious. And they were right about that. Like, that was the right thing to do.
Interesting. I was gonna say, yeah, that does seem like vinegar is a cleaner.
Right. And the ironic thing about this setup was this was the most food some of the villagers would ever get in their lives. So sure, they would die, but they would be the fullest they had ever been.
That's so crazy.
Isn't that sad?
That's like, really sad.
I know. Other measures taken included the plan to bury all the plague victims as quickly as possible and as near to the place they died rather than in the village cemetery. This was combined with the locking up of churches to avoid parishioners being crammed into church pews, and instead they moved to open-air services to avoid the spread of disease. And as weeks and months passed, it was assumed that eventually everyone in Eme would be dead. But in September of 1666, a year after the plague had initially hit Eme, the first brave outsiders made a trip into the village, and to their amazement, they were met by survivors who shared their stories of their miraculous recoveries. 260 Eme villagers died over the 14 months of the plague out of a total population of 800. So it was a lot of them, but many of them had gotten it and survived or not gotten it at all.
Okay.
So after 1666, although there were many isolated outbreaks, there were no further epidemics of the plague in England. And while the events at Eme did little to change attitudes initially, over a longer term, the medical world used Eme as a case study in the prevention of disease. Their quarantine practices definitely helped their case, but it wasn't just that, because there were people in Eme, like I said, who contracted the plague and still survived. So it wasn't just that they were quarantining really good and they didn't catch it. It's like they caught it and they lived. So that was unheard of. And scientists were like, all right, we're going to study this because clearly there's some kind of something going on.
Right.
So Joan Plant, who was a descendant of one of those survivors, told Dr. Stephen O'Brien the folklore of Eme. And one story she shared was about the village gravedigger. And in his rush to bury the dead, he pulled a man infected with the plague from his bed while he was still alive, essentially. So he dragged this person down the stairs, and halfway down, this person became conscious once again and asked the gravedigger for a drink. And after that, he ended up surviving.
Like a beer? Or just water?
I think just water, because one of the symptoms of the plague was that it made you like unquenchably thirsty.
Okay. So he's on death's door. He's like getting dragged into a grave and he just survives.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the stairs?
Yeah. You got to hit everyone on the way down and then you'll live.
Right.
From the plague.
Sure.
So even more famous than that story was the case of Margaret Blackwell. She was in the final stages of the plague and was extremely sick. But just hours after she had been left for dead by her brother Francis, she stumbled into the kitchen desperate for something to drink. And she was delirious and barely knew where she was, but she saw a milk jug on the table and immediately drank out of it, drinking what she thought was milk, but had actually been bacon fat. So she survived the plague after this. And one of the theories was that the bacon fat had cured her.
I mean, that's disgusting, but I mean, if it's going to save your life, bacon fat daily, you know? Yeah.
Bacon fat for the win. No, the idea of chugging bacon fat makes my skin crawl.
I know.
But yeah, that
Isn't it solid?
Not when it's warm.
Oh, okay.
So that was one of the theories, was that her chugging bacon fat saved her life. But let's debunk that, shall we? So local historian John Clifford wanted to see exactly who was documented, so he analyzed the parish register, which started in 1630, and listed everyone who appeared to be alive in 1665, and deleted anyone who died in the plague, and then searched the register for evidence of survivors. So he was looking at this register 20 years after the plague and found evidence of people marrying and also other ways of death over the years, which meant those people did not die of the plague. And overall, they picked out 433 people who survived in Eme.
Okay, so either they didn't get it or they got it and survived?
Correct.
Okay.
And scientists were baffled by this number, so they questioned whether it was actually the plague that hit their small village in 1665 or it was something else. So one of the diseases that showed similar symptoms to the plague was anthrax. Anthrax experts believed the two very easily could have been confused, since it's an infection that's transmitted from animals to people, and it produces itchy red lumps, which turn into blisters, which later produce an ulcer with black scabs. Anthrax actually means black. So it sounds pretty similar. So they thought possibly anthrax spores were in the cloth that infected the village tailor, and then that's what ran through Eme. Unlike plague, the anthrax blisters are rarely fatal to humans, which would explain the high survival rate in Eme. So they're like, okay, this is checking out. But there was a way to figure out if it had been anthrax, because anthrax is deadly to cows, so they would have been wiped out. And after scouring the village records, it was found that cows were alive through it all. And the villagers had inventory of their livestock, and they were high numbers of cows. So anthrax had to be ruled out as a possibility.
That's so interesting. But you're really just relying on what people wrote down.
Well, yeah. But it is telling.
Yeah, true. And what else are you going
to
do?
Right. So that, with other factors, led them to believe that it only could have been the plague that was in Eme. And the next thing to figure out was if the status or wealth had any impact on the death toll. Like, if those in high traffic areas with worse hygiene were more susceptible. Because if that were the case, then maybe the more spread out countryside village of Eme would have been less bad than, say, London, where everyone was on top of each other and there was a lot more, like, poor people and that really bad hygiene. But Justin Champion studied the records of the London plague to see if the cramped living conditions made them any more likely to die than their more affluent neighbors, and he looked at the tax records and was able to paint a very clear picture of the status of each household and basically made, like, a death map of the plague. And he found that poverty and bad hygiene and overcrowding made no difference. The death was hitting everyone. So still, the question of why Eme had so many survivors was unanswered, because not only did people get the plague and recover from it, but some people never got it at all, even after their constant exposure to the bacteria. There were quite a few people in Eme, like mothers, who cared for their sick children and husband and watched each of them die one by one and never got the plague.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So was being female something that would help you?
No.
Okay.
Because there were other cases of that. Like, there were plague doctors and, you know, people who took care of the sick and dying that weren't just women that didn't catch the plague.
Okay. We're getting closer.
Yeah, so very similarly to what I just said, a woman named Elizabeth Hancock never got the plague. She lived on the edge of the village and managed to escape the infection for a few months, but in August of 1666, it caught up to her family, claiming the lives of her youngest son, John. And within days, his sister Alice caught it, and the whole time their mother, Elizabeth, took care of them, and sadly they both passed. And one by one, her family members died. In total, she buried six of her children and her husband in the span of 1 week.
1 week?
Yeah.
Seven of her family members died?
Yes.
Who's left?
Her. Each of which she had taken care of in their sickness, and she never contracted the plague. Even more interesting.
I mean, at that point, probably would have wanted to.
Well, right.
Seven? Your whole family?
Mm-hmm.
In a week?
This was a very bad time.
Ugh.
Yeah. Even more interesting was the story of Marshall Howe. Howe had appointed himself village gravedigger and would visit the homes of the dying and steal whatever valuables he could find before loading corpses onto his cart. And he handled literally hundreds of infected people and corpses, and he never caught the plague.
Well, the whole theory about
being a woman,
morally pure,
oh,
to not catch the disease is not turning out.
Right. Exactly. So scientists and historians began theorizing that there had to be something biologically different with people who never contracted the plague or survived it. They just had good genes. And so if the genetic makeup of the survivors of Eme protected them, then they would have passed those genes down through generations, especially since the survivors in Eme intermarried with each other and spread those genes even more. And throughout the years, many of the descendants continued to stay within the community, basically making their genes photocopy. So there's still a good number of descendants of these plague survivors living in Eme, which was perfect for the scientists who wanted to figure that out. And the villagers were asked to swab the inside of their cheeks to get a DNA sample to see if they had any protective genes.
Wait, what year is the investigation happening?
Like in recent history, maybe 20 years ago?
That's so crazy. So they are literally descendants of a small town of what was 800 people down to 400. And then 400 years later, they're still in the same place.
Oh, yeah. They still had a couple of families that were like, oh, yeah, my great-great-great-grandmother's buried over there. Like,
wow. Yeah. I mean, what is it even like to grow up somewhere with such a long history?
I don't know. I mean, it's so cool. Europe is insane.
Yeah.
I love going and seeing all the history of all the places because it goes back far.
Yeah. And could you imagine, like, yep, my family's been shoemakers for 400 years.
Yeah. Yeah, I bet that's someone's story.
And I'm sorry I'm going to college.
Oh, God. And actually, I'm moving to San Francisco.
Fuck this place.
Well, okay, so there is a descendant of Eam that we're going to talk about who does live in San Francisco.
That's so funny.
Yeah. So, yeah, they went to Eam. And they got descendants to swab their cheeks for DNA.
Okay.
And they're... Okay.
Okay. And could you imagine, like, coming to them with this?
It's like, pretty okay. Cool. I'm sure they'd be down for it because literally if you look up Eam, it's known for the survivors of the plague.
Oh, and they know that?
Yeah, yeah. Of course.
Okay. I could just imagine, you know, people just chilling in the village and they're like, hey...
Completely unaware.
We need to swab that cheek.
Give me that cheek. Okay,
give me that cheek.
No, they knew that that was what it was.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like totally in the village folklore. So.
Okay.
There was one gene that Dr. Stephen O'Brien was hoping to find, a mutant member of a family of genes that plays a big role in the body's defense against disease, and that is Delta 32. He wanted to test and see if it protected against the plague, and they made sure they had direct descendants of the survivors of the plague and made sure of it by analyzing the family trees of the people they tested. Two of which were descendants of Margaret Blackwell, the woman who drank the bacon fat, and Elizabeth Hancock, whose six children and husband died of the plague. So one person who got the plague and survived, and the other who never got the plague at all. Okay, ready? Check this one out. Dr. Rick Titball.
You can't make it up.
Okay, so
can you say it one more time?
So Dr. Rick Titball was testing. He was testing how the plague attacked human cells. He's doing amazing work. We thank him for that. Your name is funny.
His time in grade school
must have been terrible.
An absolute hell.
Probably.
Mr. So, Titball.
Rick Titball. Rick Titball.
Could you imagine looking at a 10-year-old and being like, Mr. Titball, put it away.
Yeah, no.
Put it away right now. Stop acting up.
Right. So anyway, he was doing amazing work with this plague investigation. So let's get back to that. When the plague bacteria gets into the blood, the body sends an army of white blood cells to destroy them. But the plague gets inside the white blood cells and hijacks them, using them to hitch a ride to the lymph nodes, which are the center of the body's defense network. Once in the lymph nodes, it breaks out and attacks the immune system, giving the victim very little chance of survival. But they believed that the Delta 32 gene would stop the bacteria from getting into the white blood cells and keep it from attacking the body. And when they tested the first round of Eam DNA samples, they found clear evidence of Delta 32. It was present in 14% of the Eam descendants.
That doesn't sound like a lot.
It's there.
Okay.
Yeah. So they also took worldwide data and found that the original mutation started popping up in the European population roughly 700 years ago, which was just at the time that the Black Death came to Europe. And it followed the path of the Black Death.
What do you mean followed the path?
Like the popping up of the Delta 32 gene.
What? Wait, so... How does the body know to just pop up that gene?
How did it get there?
How did it?
I don't know, but it was around the time of the plague that like this mutation was occurring. So in the case of Elizabeth Hancock, who had been exposed to the plague multiple times and never even contracted it, scientists concluded that to completely block the bacteria, she must have had two copies of the protective gene, one from each of her parents. But for people like Margaret Blackwell, who did get the plague but lived through it, she most likely had only one copy of the gene. So what's so incredible about Delta 32 is that it's not only protective from the plague, but scientists discovered that it also has a protective ability to block HIV and AIDS.
Interesting.
Yeah, so Stephen Crone is the perfect example of that because he is a descendant of Eam, and he lived in San Francisco in 1980 through the height of the AIDS epidemic, and he was a gay man. So throughout those years, he watched his partner and somewhere around 70 of his friends die of AIDS.
70?
Yeah.
Wow.
Steve Crone's partner, Jerry, got sick and nobody knew what it was. His partner was like one of the first people to die of AIDS. Like he was like one of the first five people to die. He was sick for 15 months and there was never a diagnosis. And Jerry died on March 4th, 1982. So there's no reason why Steve Crone shouldn't have gotten AIDS if his partner had AIDS.
Right.
Over the last few decades, there have been 18 million deaths from AIDS worldwide. HIV has become the biggest killer of the Western world since the Black Death. Like the plague, HIV attacks the immune system and targets the white blood cells. It did almost the same thing as the plague. Like, they are very similar in that regard. So like the plague, AIDS also has symptoms that include dark purple blotches and swollen lymph nodes. And Steve Crone believed since his partner and so many of his friends had gotten AIDS and his lifestyle was exactly the same as theirs, it was only a matter of time before he got AIDS. But he never did. He called around to scientists and doctors to have himself studied because there was no reason why he should have stayed HIV negative and AIDS negative. But at the time, there were no studies for HIV negative men until he contacted doctors and said, hey, this is pretty unusual. Maybe you should study me. So Bill Paxton took the blood of high-risk men who never contracted HIV to test it, and he found that what was stopping HIV from getting into Steve's cells was the Delta 32 gene. This was an extremely exciting thing for him to learn that he would never catch HIV. And all the people with one copy of Delta 32, which is about one-fifth of the population, showed a delay in development of AIDS if they were infected with HIV. But 1% of the population with two copies of Delta 32 have almost total resistance to AIDS.
Wow.
Isn't that cool?
That is so crazy. Like, it's a recessive gene, but it helps survival. It just doesn't make sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why doesn't everyone have it?
I don't know. Around 10% of today's European population carries the mutation, which is a significantly higher proportion than in other populations. And as the centuries wore on, repeated outbreaks, culminating in the Great Plague of London in the 1660s, have occurred in tandem with the rises in the mutation's frequency. And a similar study published in 2003 suggests that a smallpox outbreak boosted the mutation's frequency as well.
Interesting. So when you say boosted the gene's frequency, is it like something that gets turned on in your DNA, or is it just that the people who survived had it?
So it's a gene mutation from my understanding. So maybe some people were able to like have their gene mutate. I'm going to state once again that I am merely a storyteller and not a scientist. So if I sound like a complete idiot to someone who actually knows, I apologize. But you know, I don't really know. But it seems like when there's a big resurgence of some sort of outbreak, like the plague or smallpox, there's more of this Delta 32 gene that pops up. And that's about as much knowledge as I have.
Okay. Delta 32 help sick.
Correct. But let's talk about what happened after the plague for a moment. Like what happened to those people in the major cities that survived? So those who survived the plague saw food prices skyrocket, and burial shrouds shot up to 10 times their earlier price. Farmers abandoned their crops, and craftsmen locked up their workshops, and there was a massive scarcity in labor. So after the deaths stopped occurring, wages shot up because there were so many less people to work. And so they were like, we need people to work, so we're going to make your wages much higher. And peasants had access to more money and better food, which made their lifespans longer. And once they had gotten a taste of slightly better lifestyle, they started kind of demanding their wages be raised and like their lifestyles be better. Because also for many people, they became rich from their family wealth being passed down to them after their entire family died, and both men and women began showing off with clothes and horses. So though many millions of people died, the Black Death permanently upended Europe's social hierarchy, which does make sense, but that's also an interesting thing. I know. It changed the balance between the rich aristocrats and the peasants, because they were like, we're not going to be peasants anymore because we need money to live and, you know, we can get it now.
Yeah.
But prior to that,
they would have never demanded it because that's just what they were used to.
Right. So prior to the devastation of the plague, the population in Europe had been on the rise, which gave the wealthy an advantage when dealing with the peasants. Wages stayed really low and rents and prices stayed really high. And there was nothing anyone could do about it because there were a lot of people to do the jobs. But that got turned on its head after the plague because 60 to 70% of the population disappeared. So European rulers who were desperate to restore the social pecking order used some unusual tactics to get back some control. So in 1349, English lawmakers set workers' wages at 1346 levels, and in 1351, it was made illegal for a healthy person to refuse work. So they basically were like, we're going to pay you what we paid you before the plague, and if you don't work, we're literally going to torture and kill you.
Oh.
Yeah. So a punishment for people who were demanding higher wages were they would be kept in, I believe they were called stocks. It was like those big wooden like things with a head hole.
Oh, you throw tomatoes?
Yeah. It's like it had a big wooden structure that had a head hole and hand holes, and they would like lock you in there. So they would keep you there for however long. Or they would have their faces branded. So they would, you know, heat up metal and put it on their faces and burn them. So this led to a social upheaval, and peasants began a rebellion. But the Black Death wasn't gone, and new diseases started popping up, and one of which was the dancing plague. Here's the weirdest part, okay? So it drove men and women to dance uncontrollably for hours or even days at a time.
Are you serious?
I am serious. the dancers took to the streets and danced until they collapsed, many of them groaning and complaining about how they couldn't stop. And one of the theories about the dancing plague is that it was caused by intense psychological distress and was basically just mass hysteria because nobody ever died from it and there's no real reason for it.
Wait, so people just danced until they collapsed and then they didn't die?
Yeah, they basically were like, I don't know how it started, but someone was like, I physically can't stop dancing. I'm sick. I'm hysterical. Like, this is a new plague, basically. And then it caught on and people just continued to start like dancing and claiming that they couldn't stop dancing. And I'm sure in their minds, they were like literally going crazy because, I mean, think about it. They had just been through one of the most devastating times in the history of the world. And they just watched millions of people literally drop like flies around them. And now they're like losing their minds. So they literally think that this dancing plague was just mass hysteria.
That's so crazy. I mean, I guess you could maybe kind of understand how everyone gets there if they're, I mean, if you watch everyone around you die and you're stressed and you think it's coming for you again, I guess.
Just put a little boogie in your step.
Just get out there and
bust cut a rug.
Yeah, bust a move. Could you imagine? That's their campaign to stop the plague. Bust a move to stop the plague.
Yeah, to save your life.
Save my life.
So that's a ridiculous fact that I found about the plague. But over the centuries, the plague is estimated to have killed at least 200 million people. That's a lot of people.
Yep.
The Black Death epidemic had run its course by the early 1350s, but then the plague reappeared, as we talked about, every few generations for centuries. And modern sanitation and public health practices have greatly mitigated the impact of the disease, but has not eliminated it. While antibiotics are available to treat the Black Death, according to the World Health Organization, there are still 1,000 to 3,000 cases of the plague every year. Mammals such as rabbits, hares, and some cat species are susceptible to the bubonic plague and typically die upon contraction. And I was actually watching a video on these scientists who were monitoring the plague, and they did that by monitoring these small animals like gophers or marmots, something like that. But they basically knew that if these animals started dying all at once, they should be concerned about the plague. So they just like track these animals, and if they all drop dead one day, they're like, okay, so the plague is back.
And we have a problem.
Right.
So have they, is there a solution? I mean, you could just do antibiotics?
Yeah, so now you're able to treat the plague if you catch it early enough with like antibiotics, but there are still people that die. So yeah, like there was a man who caught the plague recently from his cat, because his cat got the plague and died, and he like handled his cat's dead body, and then he caught the plague. And then he went to the doctor, and he was like not too far off from where it's like no longer treatable, but he had like just caught it in time and they were able to treat him. But his fingers turned black and like everything, and he got treated and he was okay. But like he got the plague. Like,
wow.
Yeah. Prevention is through public health measures such as not handling dead animals in areas where plague is common. And while vaccines against the plague have been developed, the World Health Organization recommends that only high-risk groups, such as certain laboratory personnel and healthcare workers, get vaccinated for it. And there are several antibiotics effective for treatment, like I mentioned. But without treatment, the plague results in the death of 30 to 90% of those infected. Death, if it occurs, is typically within 10 days. With treatment, the risk of death is around 10%. Globally, between 2010 and 2015, there were 3,248 documented cases, which resulted in 584 deaths. And the countries with the greatest number of cases are the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Madagascar, and Peru. And between 1900 and 2015, the United States had 1,036 human plague cases, with an average of 9 cases per year, although the deaths are far less common, with just 14, between 2000 and 2020. So there's all your numbers.
14 people over, what, did you say 10 years?
2000 to 2020.
20. That's not too bad.
In the U.S.
I would have to say that the U.S. has beat the plague.
Kind of, yeah. Clearly, they've been managing it for a long, long time, and it seems like it's fine. But, you know, yeah. It's something that they have to watch.
Well, I mean, it's like if it does pop up, we just need to make more antibiotics.
Sure.
You know, there's already a cure.
Yeah, there are antibiotics for it. So that's good. But, you know, so, like the pneumonic plague is really bad and spreads really quick and you die really fast, and it's like something that they definitely monitor for safety purposes. But yeah. That is all the information I have on the bubonic plague. I know we kind of jumped around in our years and whatever, but I hope we all managed to follow.
Yeah, no, it was good. It was a lot of good info. Yeah, I just, it is hard to put yourself there, and
I could not even imagine
the full vibe of the time.
Yeah, like we have obviously been through a massive health event, like the pandemic. Like we're just now getting back to like semi-normal from like what it was. But even COVID was nothing compared to the Black Death.
Yeah, I mean, I think COVID was like what, 2 or 3% of people?
I don't know the percentage, but comparing the two, the Black Death is way worse. Like
100%.
Yeah. And I mean, think about how terrible it was for us. You know, like everyone here was having a terrible time. And yeah, of course we were. Like it was awful. But think about that times like 10,000. So overall, terrible time to be alive. 10 out of 10 would not want to be alive when the Black Death occurred.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's pretty safe to say.
Also, just being alive in that year sucked anyway.
Yeah, it would have been bad without the Black Death.
Right.
But then add but that on top.
Mix that in? I mean, fuck.
Yeah.
Now we're really talking.
So true.
I still can't believe that in some weird way, the doctors figured out what to wear.
I know.
That would help them.
Yeah. That part was interesting to me. That, like, death costume is so iconic. And, like, yeah, it is really cool that it actually did somewhat prevent the plague from being spread to them. It makes sense.
Yeah.
I don't know how well it prevented like the pneumonic plague, because there were like nose holes and, you know, they were still kind of breathing in that air, but it definitely stopped like blood droplets and like other bodily fluids from getting them, or like the fleas. So two types of the plague was stopped by the bird mask. Like, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. Although for the pneumonic plague, it kind of sounded like there was no helping you.
No, the pneumonic plague, you were done. And it was like quick, like 2 days, if that.
Wow.
I mean, think about it. I can't remember her name, but that woman whose 6 children and husband died, like they were all of them dead within a week. Like, they must have had the pneumonic plague and like passed it on to all of them, and they all died within a week. Yeah, a terrifying time to be alive, if nothing else. And also, I didn't mention this when we were talking about like the aftermath of it all, but there were a lot of survivors who had like massive survivor's guilt.
Yeah, and I was going to ask if so many people died. I mean, I know that people's wages went up, but did they just loot?
Yeah,
like, people did. Like, if your entire families died?
Totally.
I guess, what are they going to do with their stuff?
Yeah, well, so if an entire family died, then yeah, their place was just like...
Ransacked
for sure. But if there was one person still alive in that family, all of the wealth and things that that family owned went to that one person, which is why people became rich so quickly. And then they were like, okay, I'm no longer a peasant, and so I'm no longer going to be treated as a peasant, and if you do, I will riot. And that's why there was a riot.
It's really interesting.
It's super interesting. Yeah, but anyway, that is all the information I have on the plague. Why don't we get out of the darkness? Tell me something good. What's your good thing?
My good thing is that tomorrow is our 6-year anniversary.
Wow.
We've been together for 6 years.
Six whole years. I think that was our good thing last week.
Was it?
I think so.
Well, it's still a good thing this week.
Hey, it's still good this week. Yeah, that's true. Actually, when this episode comes out, it will have already been our 6-year anniversary. So
that's my good thing. I'm excited to go get dinner and get a little silly.
Hell yeah. My good thing is that I have been doing some stage combat again, which is really exciting. For those of you who don't know, I have done stage combat before. It's basically like fighting for theater. It's with like fake weapons and fake fighting. And it's a lot of fun. And yeah, I'm doing it again. And shout out to my professor, Christina, because she is obsessed with the plague and she was excited that I was going to do this episode. So hey, girl. but yeah, no, I love stage combat, and I learned a knife fight the other day, which is so fun because I haven't done that in a good couple years. So it was fun to be in that setting again and learn a fight and do it.
Yeah, no, it looked really good. You showed me a video of it. I don't know. I'm always kind of, because when you teach me the techniques and you're like, oh, this is actually how it happens, and it makes it look real on stage, it's super cool.
Yeah, it's so much fun. It's one of my favorite things. So
my favorite one is you grab somebody's hair and then you like slam their face into a chair, but you miss,
or a wall, floor.
But you just like smack your hand on whatever it is. But if you do it at full speed, it really looks real.
That's the idea of stage combat, is you,
I know, but you know, I just
fake things look real. But yeah, I mean, I was teaching Alex about it at one point a couple months ago, so I taught him a couple moves, and I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah, I've gotten bits and pieces out of you over the years.
Yeah,
but, you know, just as an outsider, to like see the magic behind it is kind of cool.
Yeah, I love
it. Or the technique, whatever. Totally. You want to call it.
Absolutely, both are right. But anyway, thank you all so much for listening. If you would like to check out the bonus episode that came out this week, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. We have a bunch of bonus episodes over there and a bunch of other perks. Head over there. Get your merch while it's hot at nottodaypodcast.myshopify.com. If you or anyone you know has a story of survival that you would like to share with us and possibly hear on an upcoming listeners episode, send it to notodaypodcast@gmail.com. We have pictures of all the stories we talk about over on Instagram, nottoday_podcast. We have a TikTok that is Not Today Podcast and a Twitter that is Not Today Podcast, but the T on the podcast is a 3.
Because that makes sense.
And just keep breathing.
Yeah.
Yeah.